I call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is Thursday, February 29 at 1:45 p.m. Present today, we have Representative Josephson, Representative Hannon, Representative Galvin, Representative Stapp, Representative Cologne, Representative Ortiz, Representative Cronk, Representative Tomaszewski, Co-Chair Edgman, Co-Chair Foster, myself, Co-Chair Johnson, and we are assisted today by Emily Mesh and our LIO moderator and our committee secretary, Leah Frazier. Welcome to House Finance. Thank you for your patience. Today, the committee will receive an overview of the proposed FY25 budget for the Department of Law, and then an overview of the proposed FY25 budget for the Alaska court system. First, we have an overview of the proposed FY25 budget for the Department of Law, and here to present in the room, we have Attorney General Craig Taylor. Welcome. Deputy Attorney General John Skidmore, Criminal Division. Welcome. And online, we have Deputy Attorney General Corey Mills from the Civil Division and Amber LeBlanc, the Administrative Services Division. And members... Corey. I'm sorry. Welcome to House Finance, Corey. Good to have you here. And I do know who you are. It's good to have you here. We will, Department of Law is always a, an interesting presentation, and we all like to talk to you. So we'll try to allow members to ask questions, but if we have too many, we'll slow it down. But for now, I'll start by asking members if they have any questions to begin. And if not, we'll go ahead and get started. All right. Welcome.
Thank you, Representative Johnson, members of the House Finance Committee. It's our pleasure to be here before you presenting our budget overview for 2025. I'm going to use chair loosely in here. If etiquette is supposed to be chairs, please interpret chair to be chairs.
Okay, so I will say, first of all, make sure to introduce yourself, put yourself on the record when you speak, but also our agreement is that we are co-chairs, and whoever is holding the gavel for the day is the chair.
Got it. So that simplifies my my actions here. So I'm Craig Taylor. I'm the Attorney General. On my left is John Skidmore. He's our Deputy Attorney General over the Criminal Division. And then we have Corey Mills to my right, who is the Deputy over our Civil Division. In reserve, if we should fall, is Amber LeBlanc, who is on the telephone. And in the room with us, I want to recognize some members of our staff, some important people, Danny Mackey, Parker Patterson, and Casey Schroeder are behind us in the room. Our mission with the Department of Law is the Department of Law upholds. Sorry, you want to click that? Thank you. I'm going to hand that.
Yes, I will do that.
Our mission in the Department of Law, the Department of Law upholds the rule of law, protects public safety, and provides high-quality legal representation to executive branch agencies for the benefit of all Alaskans. And that is a mission that we worked on a couple years ago, and we put a lot of thought into that mission, and it really does mean something to us and represent exactly when we got questions of whether we should wade into something. That's the rubric. On the next slide, we've been very fortunate in the Department of Law to have continuity with our leadership team over the last several years. Oddly enough, at 3 years, I'm one of the longest serving AGs in the past few. And so it's been really nice to have this team in place and be able to work with them on a day-to-day basis. I've already introduced some members of our team. Not with us today are Angie Kemp and Stacy Crayley, civil directors for both the Criminal Division and the Civil Division. The next slide is just an overview. You can get sort of a glance at an eye level of our budget comparisons, the 2023 actuals you see there, and then the FY2024 management plan, and then the FY2025 governor's request. You can see a slight increase that increase is sort of not a real increase. It represents just pulling out the multi-year funds from the actuals. So basically, the actuals being less than the 2024 management plan shows that we didn't spend all of the multi-year statehood defense and that those are being reserved for the continuing years. On our next slide, wanted to highlight a really cool video. If you have time to click that link, But basically, I'm very proud of the department and what we do. This link was a way for me to sort of brag about the great things, amazing work that our attorneys are doing and our staff are doing. The video features are actual people. They're not actors. They may seem like it. They are actual attorneys that work in the Department of Law, and they're talking about the good works that they do. And it varies. You'll see in the video just a representation of the vast breadth of the type of law that we practice, from prosecuting on one side and the civil division on the other, doing a lot of many different things. The purpose of the video was sort of threefold. One, inspire our own team. Two, tell our story to Alaskans that sometimes wonder what the AG, that's the number one question. When I walk into a room of folks, they have no idea what the AG really does. And so this sort of get out our story of what we do, that we're a resource in a lot of cases to the Alaskan public, and specifically in our consumer protection division. And the third reason for this video is to motivate others to join our team.
How long is it?
I believe it's, we cut it down for the purpose of this. It's like 6 minutes.
The total video, this is John Skidmore for the record. The total video is about 15 minutes. We had originally tried to reduce it to about six for you all, and we were told that was still too long of a video to play. So unfortunately, that was ixnayed. I don't think that was by you all, but we were told it was too long to play in this setting. So we just have the link, and we'd encourage people to look at it. It's a chance for you all to hear directly from people on the line, as the Attorney General said.
Yeah.
All right. Very good.
Thank you. Next slide. So one of our big requests to the legislature this year is for paid interns. And so historically, our interns have not been paid. And so you're probably asking, okay, what's changed? What gives? The answer is, in short, is that that's now no longer feasible in today's market. We're competing for far, far fewer law students. And I think John will speak to some of those specifics in a little bit. But there's just no longer the ability to not pay an intern. And these interns, by the way, they do great things for the Department of Law. And they do different things. They're allowed to do different things on the criminal side. Those interns are, show up in court, represent the state in hearings. So there's good value that we get from these interns. But the big reason for the internships is to create and generate future employees of the Department. They get a taste of Alaska. A lot of them aren't from Alaska. They fall in love with Alaska, and they say to themselves, wow, that was really fun. Look at all the different types of law I could do with the Department of Law. Some of these things that we do are you can only do in an AG's office in Alaska. And so that's the idea behind our internships. And I think the proof is in the pudding on this, is that half of our current leadership were interns for the Department of Law. And our ranks are just full of prior interns. And we're seeing similar trends on that internship need on both civil and criminal. But I just wanted John and Corey to be able to speak to that just a little bit while we're on this page. And so go ahead, John.
For the record, John Skidmore. What I can tell you about the criminal division's attempt to recruit interns this year, we had 166 applications, which sounds great. Unfortunately, 93% of those ended in negative outcomes. We actually only extended offers in 57 of those instances. From those 57, only 11 have accepted positions with us. Some of those are first year, some of those are second year interns from law school, but that means that we had a significant portion who declined. 23 of them who declined expressly cited a lack of pay that we could offer them. The other 21 or so that had declined indicated things like a lack of housing or we accepted a different position, but that's 40% of the people we extended offers to that expressly declined due to a lack of pay. And if you want to know how that translates, I would simply refer to some of our competitors. We looked around and we tried to see what were other people that were going after the same pool of individuals paying them. They were paying somewhere between $2,400 and $4,200 a month. These are places like the Multnomah DA's office, the Bronx DA's office, Ramsey County in St. Paul, Minnesota, throughout the state of Michigan with the Prosecutors Association, Pierce County, which is Tacoma, Washington, the Utah AG's office, King County, Seattle, Washington. All of these other individuals were paid. The Attorney General referenced a moment ago that we used to not be able to pay our folks. Corey Mills is an example of somebody that was an intern that's come back, and the department has benefited greatly from being able to have her with us full time. My deputy, or excuse me, my director, Angie Kemp, also was a previous intern. But when we look at what's going on, law school grads over the last decade have shrank dramatically. We used to graduate somewhere around 46 to 44,000 law school grads every year. We're down to about 34. That's 10,000 fewer law school grads each and every year. This is one of the things that prosecutors around the country have been talking about in our difficulties in trying to hire people, but also applies to interns. That reduction in the pool from which we can draw is dramatic. And so for in order for us to be more competitive, unfortunately, we've gotten to the point where we've said we do need to be able to pay interns to attract them. And the Attorney General was right. Our ranks are filled with people that used to be interns for us. So it's a wonderful pipeline. It's just something that we're looking for ways to be able to continue in the future. And I'd let Ms. Mills talk about what the civil side sees.
Yeah, Corey Mills, again, for the record. I would just echo a lot of John's sentiments. We've also had a 40% declination rate this year, all citing pay or housing. And that has resulted in basically our pool is down to 1L students, which isn't bad, but these are first-year law students. If you're a second-year law student, you can actually go to court and do hearings. It also is more likely if you're a second-year law student that interns with us, you're more likely to come back. You're more likely to be looking for what your long-term career is. So not only are we looking for more 2L students to apply and join us, we're also looking to broaden the pool of schools that we can get students from. There are, if you look at your Ivy League schools, for example, they give stipends. And so they don't have as much of a financial issue with coming up, and so we tend to get kind of Ivy League school. That's not bad. They come up and experience Alaska, but it's also kind of like a paid vacation, and they may not really be looking to come back. We want to connect to schools, in Western America, or schools that happen to be in places that have law that really is applicable to Alaska, tribal law, natural resource law, and you're finding that more in, for example, your state university schools. Which it's just harder for those students to afford to come up. So that's the other benefit of paying, is that I think we broaden our pool of students who don't have to have some sort of independent way of paying. We can offer them to come up as well, and they're more likely to stay for the long term.
Yeah. I'll
go ahead.
Okay, I'll echo that. I mean, if you look at our list of last year's interns, you think, well, it looks like you guys are doing terrific, because you'll see these schools on there, fantastic. Multiple from Harvard, multiple from Yale, multiple from Stanford. And you'll also notice that most of them are 1Ls. And in 1L year, if you're familiar, it's sort of a scramble, get what you can get, because there's just not a lot of opportunity out there for 1Ls. Your 2L year, you better be starting to narrow down where you want to work, because you're really looking for future employment. You're starting to see the student debt pile up. And it's no longer just the vacation your 1L summer was. And so really what we're trying to get are those students that are seriously considering move to Alaska, which is dramatic. I think many of you have probably made that move, and learn and be looking for a home once they're done with law school. And so that's the push, and that's why we're making this request. The next slide has some more additional.
Yes, we have Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, through the chair. This makes a lot of good sense, good reasoning behind this particular request. My question is, for an intern to qualify to be an intern, is it a law degree from any university that's the qualification, or is there any other further qualifications that would allow them to apply? Not to say that you would accept any intern just with a law degree, mm-hmm. but what's the minimum qualifications a person has to have to apply? And it looks like the internship lasts for 3 months, and it's usually during the summertime. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. Okay. Madam, through the chair, Representative Ortiz, yes, these are summer programs that are designed for between your years of law school.
Okay.
And so our requirement is that you have finished your first year of law school.
Okay.
Yep.
I have a question on the number that you have. You have a total of 58. How did you come up with that number? I mean, it's very specific, I guess.
Do you want to start, John?
Sure.
Okay.
Madam Chair, for the record, John Skidmore. So 23 of those are for the criminal division. And what we did is we looked around the state and we counted the number of district attorney's offices and other offices we have. And we looked historically at how many positions each of the offices had taken or would be capable of handling. And so 23 of them are specifically for the criminal division. And to also follow up on Representative Ortiz's question, we in the criminal division are less interested in the 1Ls. We're not looking to pay 1Ls. We're looking to pay 2Ls. Mm-hmm. Why? Because they are authorized under regulations in the state of Alaska that govern attorneys to actually appear in court. We're looking for people who can go and do arraignments, can go and do bail hearings, get an experienced second chair in a trial. And so those are the ones we're focused on. And when we have the dollar figure there, that's associated with 2Ls because the PCNs that are created for it are a graduate intern too, something that already exists in state statute. And that's where the dollar figure comes from because it's associated with that specifically. And so we're looking for 2Ls. We'll welcome 1Ls. We're probably not going to pay 1Ls, though, the way we're going to pay 2Ls because we can get more out of them than that. As for the other specifics of how the civil division came up with their numbers, I'll turn that over to Deputy Attorney General Mills.
And again, Corey Mills, for the record, we did a very similar look back on what our internship program has had in the past, as well as capacity in terms of just the ability to supervise those interns, what we thought we could get. And ours also includes externships. So the criminal division, it's harder to do an externship with the criminal division. We have more of an opportunity. Now, if they don't come to Alaska, they wouldn't get paid. But if we have an extern that wants to come up for a semester, for example, we would pay them. So that additional capacity, we have about, 23 to 25 spots in the summer and about 10 spots available for externships. As John indicated, this amount accounts for if we could get all 2Ls and pay them. Because again, the 1Ls, because they can't go to court, we would pay travel and housing for them, a small stipend. But we just felt like we really want to incentivize the 2Ls, which is why we would pay for that level.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Through the chair, first of all, a quick comment and then two questions. This is the best recruitment plan that I've seen sitting in finance over the last just 13 months, where each and every department has said we suffer from vacancy rates. And we have seen things like we need bonus, we need to give better and more overtime, and all sorts of different things that isn't necessarily bringing in more energy into Alaska. So I want to commend you and thank you because this is huge. It's such a model for others in my mind. I want to say that when we know of what Alaska needs, and by the way, I've heard from Division of Correction, Department of Corrections, Department of Public Safety, our issues around troopers, firefighters, and on and on and on. So we have heard a lot of different ideas. When I think about the teaching and the nursing staff that we need in this state and the idea that we're spending over $20 million just to try to recruit and how we still haven't quite moved the dial at all. And now you've made our imagination go wild. Summer reading academies, bringing in second, third, fourth year teachers, right? So now my question. I am doing the math on this and trying to understand your numbers. I think I see $83.20 a month if I add all of this up, and I'm not sure if that's how it goes. But if so, that's what I'm seeing, which means about $25,000 a summer per person. Is that about, am I reading that right?
I think the only clarification is that the housing stipend is for the entire summer.
Aha. Uh-huh. So that does reduce it substantially.
Yeah. Yeah. The airfare is one time. The housing stipend is one time.
Correct.
Aha. Uh-huh. Thank you. So and what does that work out to then for the summer for each of these, if I may follow up, Chair Johnson?
Yes.
So the total amount is what I'm asking for.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, John Skidmore, for the record, we've actually broken this out in a spreadsheet. We'd be happy to provide that to the committee so that you all can see it. But the way it works is that the airfare is one time, the housing stipend should cover what's there, and then it's really the costs that are associated with them. You have the range on there, but We ran this through our admin division, which covers all the different costs associated with positions. And so if we can, I'd like to provide you with that spreadsheet just so that you all can see how it's broken down yourselves. And I think that'll be easier.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Representative Hannon. We have on tap, we have Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Cologne, and followed by Representative Hannon. So what I'm hoping is that you guys will cover everything that's on the next page, which is all about the intern, so we can go on to the... I'm hoping that the questions will cover everything we need to know about interns, and hopefully we'll move on to the next section. Go ahead, Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Appreciate that. And my question was actually just answered, but just want to commend you all on this presentation of how you are actually getting, you know, more folks involved and better labor pool. Looks like great leadership. And yeah, that was my my question was on the housing stipend that you just answered. So thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And next up, we have Representative Plum.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Thank you for being here. This is probably for you, Mr. Skidmore. So when you initially said that, it sounded like you had interns that you were going to start paying, but it looks like maybe you're adding intern positions. Can you tell me how many of these are existing and how many more you want to add?
Through the chair, Representative Cologne, what I indicated is that this year we've managed to recruit 11. If I could have gotten 23 this year, I absolutely would have. But we had 13, two of them then backed out because we couldn't pay them. Mm-hmm. And so they were taking jobs elsewhere. So we're looking for a total of 23. That's what our goal is. We've only been successful in recruiting 11 so far this year, but it's not adding more than what we had previously. What I will say is that because we haven't paid them previously, we didn't have PCNs, the personnel code number that goes along with it. We didn't have those previously because we weren't paying them. We didn't need that. Okay. So there is an addition of those numbers, but that's only because we start paying them really end.
Okay, follow up. Just to clarify, so the 58, I think it's 58, you said 58 positions, you have some of those interns in both divisions now, but they don't have a PCN attached to them. So now you're creating, your goal is for 58 with PCNs.
Through the chair, Representative Cologne, John Skidmore again, yes. Okay. Our goal is to have a total of 58. We'll have some of them now, but that's the total number we're aiming for in the future, and there would be PCNs created for all 58. Because right now we don't pay anything.
All right, thank you.
Next up, we have Representative Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. So my question has to do with the ratio of criminal versus civil. So 23 criminal interns leads me to conclude there are 35 civil. It's about a 60-40 split. So in our permanent jobs, is it about 60% civil jobs at the department and 40% criminal?
Corey Mills, for the record, it's actually about 50-50. Yeah. The reason for the change is that we can offer more externship opportunities. So 10 of those positions are actually potential externships that take place during the school year over a semester. The criminal division, just in the way they're set up and the needs they have, that doesn't quite work out. So we're at about 25. So we're at about equal on the number of summer interns. And then it's the additional externships that puts us over the top for that 35.
And Representative Hannon, through the chair, I'll add to that in that they're different type of work. A lot of the interns we get are trained in law school to do more of the civil side work. They're used to researching a legal issue and writing a memo. They're really good at that. We can just turn them loose. We give them the assignment, turn them loose. On the prosecutorial side, that's a whole new world for some of these people. And so they come in knowing nothing about that world, especially the 1Ls that come in, because I think most crim law is your second year or third year. And so it takes a lot more hands-on, and that's another difference for the disparity in those, is because the criminal interns can be more hands-on in the beginning, takes more manpower to get them going, and then in the criminal, we just can set them loose, or in the civil side, we can just set them loose.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
I don't think there's all right. anything on this slide.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything on this slide that we need to go. We'll move right on into the criminal division. And Madam Chair, permission to turn this over to John for the criminal division.
For the record, John Skidmore, slide number 8 that you have in front of you is just the criminal division mission. We always like to emphasize that it's our mission to seek justice and to promote public safety. And that's going to be tied into all of the additional slides that you see coming on the criminal division budget. Slide number 9 is really just sort of saying where those requests are going to be. It's an outline of where we're going. There are 5 of them listed up there. I think in your budget materials, it's actually listed as 3 because the last 3 on the slide are combined into a single item in your budget books. We broke them out because they deal actually with different policy issues, and I'm going to go through each one of those individually. So I'm going to move on to slide 10, which talks about change in sexual assault consent laws. Many of you will recall several years ago, HB 325 passed. That was the change in the consent for sexual assault laws. It expanded some of the conduct that qualified as sexual assaults. The way in which that bill passed actually resulted in no fiscal notes being attached. You may remember some of this from last year. You had the defense agencies that had come in and had actually made requests of you all last year. Those were approved and actually enacted. It came out to a little over $3 million that those two state agencies had received. Our request is actually only $2.3 million. And the slide lays out for you how that's broken down in terms of positions. I'm going to move on to the next slide, which is slide number 11, which deals with training. One of the things that we found is the importance of training. When we look at what the Department of Law does, it's really providing services. Those services are provided by our personnel. That makes our personnel our most valuable asset. What makes the personnel even more valuable is when they really understand the things that they need to be doing. You heard the Attorney General already reference the idea that when folks come in, even in the intern positions, we really have a lot of training that we need to be able to do with them. And it's that training that's critically important. We've heard that from our own folks as well. A quick stat for you, if you were to break down the criminal division, approximately 60% of our prosecutors have 2 years or less of experience right now. Let me say that again. 60% of our prosecutors have 2 or less years of experience. That's significant.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just on that statistic alone, is that you're implying that that's a significant increase from the last 5 years, or in other words, they have less and less experience than they did 5 years ago, 10 years ago. Is that correct?
Through the chair to Representative Ortiz, yes, what I'm indicating is that the percentage of our department that is that inexperienced is greater now than what we had seen in the past. Okay. That's the type of turnover that we've been seeing. So training becomes critically important. And what the slide lays out for you all is that there are two types of academies that we've been able to implement over the last 18 months. One is for prosecutors, and the other one is for our paralegals. And the slide lays out for the prosecutors, for example, there's a 2-week academy that we run for new prosecutors. The first week deals with substantive law. Another one deals with trial advocacy. We do it twice a year. It's approximately 20 attendees every time we hold it. And we bring in 3 to 5 trainers to do that as well. We've managed to fund these training academies thus far based on some of the vacancy rates that we've had. But moving forward, because we've had some more success with training, some more success with recruiting and filling positions, we want to make sure that we have adequate money to continue those training programs. The amount that you see up here of $100,000 is the amount that we've been able to determine, having held 3 of these programs now over the last 18 months, we've been able to determine that the average we would need in a given year is approximately $100,000.
Representative Stapp. I'm sorry. I think Representative Stapp.
Oh, thank you, Madam Co-Chair, through the chair, to our wonderful law people. Sorry to wind back the clock on this, but I did actually do the math, and you're $60,000 off on your intern number. Is that like an admin cost? It's not in the slide. Back on page 6 in.
Through the chair to Representative Stapp, this is why I indicated that I wanted to be able to provide you all the spreadsheet of exactly how we came up with all the costs. There are administrative costs associated with it. The overall, I'm certain of, because we've looked at it multiple times, but we can provide you that spreadsheet that breaks down all the costs.
Yeah, I mean, it works out really close through the chair. I just assume it's a $60,000 admin cost, but you know, I don't know if I need a spreadsheet. You could just maybe tell me if I'm right or wrong. But anyways, you can continue. Thanks.
So I think those were all the points that I wanted to make on the training slide there for running both of those two academies and the amounts that are associated with it. From there, I'm going to move on to slide number 12.
One second here. I just want to make note, just for those that didn't know, Representative Kronk is our chair for the Department of Law. And so if you have something you want to make note of, you might let him know. All right, just administrative note. All right, very good.
So we're on slide 12, and what this one talks about is the increase in drug prosecutions that we've seen. The slide sort of speaks for itself. There is an increased amount in the amount of drugs that we've seized in any given year. Between last year and this year, for instance, there's been a 300% increase in fentanyl, a 300% increase. There was 87 kilos of fentanyl seized coming into Alaska. For those of you that don't remember, the amount of fentanyl it takes to kill somebody is minuscule. It's like the head of a pin. That's where you get one pill can kill. That's a slogan that the DEA came up with that's been all around the country because it takes such a small quantity. The head of a pin, 87 kilos. That's what came into our state that we seized in 2023. The number of deaths have also skyrocketed between 21 and 22. Prior to that, we saw much lower numbers. Between in the last 5 years, since 2018, the number of overdose deaths has increased 135%. That's the challenges that we're facing. In looking at prosecutions, these cases don't just result in seizures of drugs. There's also people that are arrested and charged with offenses. We're looking for two additional positions, a prosecutor and a paralegal. And to specifically relate that to what we are encountering in prosecution, I turn to slide number 13. And this shows you the increase that we've had in drug prosecutions. There has been a 65% increase in the cases charged since 2018. There are currently over 250 active cases, though there's another 125 that are awaiting to be screened to decide whether or not charges should be filed for them. And we only have two prosecutors that we're able to dedicate to this currently. That means they have an active caseload of about 125 cases per attorney and 75 cases per screening. We are, the research we've done indicates that the national average should be closer to 90 or 100 cases per attorney. So you can see we're over what's really needed there. And with the increases that we've seen, increases that we're expecting to continue, what we're really looking for is to just add that additional prosecutor so that these prosecutions can be more effective in the long term. I'm going to move on then to slide number 14.
Representative Tomaszewski.
Yeah, through the chair. So that fentanyl that you seize, I mean, what happens to that? Do they sell it back to the drug manufacturer? Do you destroy it? Where does that go exactly?
Through the chair to Representative, the fentanyl or any illegal drugs that we seize are destroyed. Generally, if there is property that is illegal, we have to forfeit the property. But when the possession of the property itself is straight out illegal, then we are authorized to destroy it. If it is needed for a case, it's preserved until the case is prosecuted, because sometimes people want to question whether or not the product that was seized from them is a drug or not. So we have to keep it available for purposes of trial. But once the trial is completed and appeals are completed, then we do in fact destroy the evidence that's illegal to possess. And in this case, the fentanyl would be illegal to possess.
Thank you. Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Through the chair. Mr. Skidmore, I'm just looking at the charge, indicted, and convicted, and I presume that you've got a year-by-year comparisons, but that a charge from 2018 isn't also an indicted and convicted in 2018. So can you give me a guesstimate of, if I'm looking at you were charged in 2020, are you convicted in 2023? Because I'm looking to just see, you know, the first bar graph is where you really see that, wait a minute, in 2018, we only convicted 10. That, right, yep. And then I went, oh, wait, let me recalibrate my brain.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, thank you for the question. You are absolutely correct that it's rare for someone to be charged and then convicted in the same year. It can happen, but usually if that happens, it's because there's been a plea to resolve the case. If there's a trial that's necessary, that clearly takes much more time. The way I looked at these graphs and the way that I interpreted them is I looked at 23, and the difference between the number of cases that we charged and the number of cases that we're able to resolve was 64. If you go back to 22, the difference between the number of cases we charged and the number we were able to resolve is 34. Go back and do the same thing for 21, the difference is 31 cases. In 20, it was 53 cases. In 19, it was 56 cases. The point that I'm making is that while you're correct that it takes longer for the case to go through the system, if you want the system to be at equilibrium, every year, however many you bring in, you should be disposing of as well. Think of it like the kitchen sink. Whatever's coming in, you need to have the same amount go out. Otherwise, it starts to overflow and it becomes problematic.
One follow-up, because that's what I'm thinking, but I'm trying to figure out where my, if I'm looking at 2023 and 180 have been charged, right, is my, you use the term resolve, so is that my 116 convicted?
The challenge, through the chair, Representative Hannon, the challenge with trying to do it that simply.
Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out where your numbers. You quickly rattled off a secondary number, and I'm
make sure you're speaking through the chair.
Through the chair. So I'm trying to track the numbers you used in my answer to just follow you.
So what I did is I compared 180 to 116. The difference of that is 64.
Okay.
When I go in 2022, the difference.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Where are we? We are back with Representative Tom Shosey speaking through the chair.
Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson. Through the chair. So our, like if somebody does a plea agreement, is that in the convicted list or is there another list that pleas out? And then I guess if they're set free, I mean, is the plea agreements in the convicted charts on this graph here?
Through the chair, Representative, yes.
Okay.
Pleas are included within convicted. If you plead, you are convicted. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Moving on to the budget. Back to budget, page 14.
Okay. So the next slide that we had then talks about investigators. You all heard us come and talk last year about trying to get a single investigator position. And at the time we did that, it was split up for a number of different purposes. And what we've determined is the best use for investigators from our standpoint is to have them focus on the following up of domestic violence and sexual assaults. This is what we see down in the lower 48. Our request is to be able to have six of those positions. The amount that you see in the lower right-hand corner is the amount that those six positions would cost us. And though I think it's technically listed as all of them being in the Office of Special Prosecutions, that's not actually the way we would divide them up. So I've listed here on the slide for you where those various positions would be based. Okay, I'm going to move on then to the next slide, which is slide number 10. I think 15, excuse me, slide number 15. I apologize. And slide number 15 talks about investigative grand juries. This is something that is allowed under the Alaska Constitution, Article 1, Section 8. And what we've seen over the last several years is an increase in the demand from citizens to have investigative grand juries conducted. That increase in demand creates challenges for us because the criminal division, though we always deal with grand juries, we're focused primarily on prosecution. Investigative grand juries are not necessarily limited to simply prosecution. In fact, many of the requests that we've had more recently are not about prosecution at all. And so what does that translate to us? Well, that means that I now have to take a prosecutor off the line, and instead of prosecuting cases, they now have to learn the law. They have to learn the constitutions, the statutes, the regulations, the court rules, all of those things around whatever area this may be in, whether it's the Office of Children's Services. We've had complaints about the ways in which that system operates. So now one of our people has to learn all about that area of the law, in addition to learning all about the rules and the regulations that surround investigative grand juries themselves. That takes significant time, unfortunately. There's also the practice and policy in whatever area that you have to delve into. What are the facts around this particular issue that is requesting to be investigated? How do you go about obtaining the evidence for those various things? What harm, if any, is caused by the things that are being complained about? All of this takes time away and, unfortunately, prevents us from our primary focus, which is that prosecution of cases. And so the request here is to have three positions, a prosecutor, a paralegal, and a law office assistant, to be able to conduct this work so that it doesn't take away from the other work that we would typically do. The last thing that I want to say about this is that right now it's scheduled or listed in the budget as being part of special prosecutions. That's one of the units that we have within the criminal division. However, there have been internal conversations, and we haven't finished those yet, about the appropriate placement for these individuals. It may be more appropriate, for example, to place them directly under the Attorney General, because there are times in which the complaints that are made are about things that folks either on the civil side or on the criminal side have to deal with on a daily basis. And so then assigning one of our people to handle that becomes more problematic. We've had several cases we had to hire outside counsel or special prosecutors to be appointed to do those sorts of things. So we're still figuring out the correct placement for those personnel, but that doesn't change the need for the personnel overall.
All right, and we have a question from Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, through the Chair. Mr. Skidmore, on the portion of the slide, well, first of all, if you could just give a brief definition of what an investigative grand jury is. Mm-hmm. Second of all, recent increased demand, from where does that demand come from? In other words, there's a $502,000 ask for, which is a brand new ask. It's not adding on to a pre-existing amount, correct? It's a brand new ask.
Yes.
So the question would be, why now in 2025 budget are we asking for this now? So I guess that would get back to the recent increased demand. From where does that come? If you could.
Through the chair to Representative Ortiz, let me start with investigative grand juries. Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution says that if someone's going to be charged with a felony offense, that has to go through a grand jury process.
Okay.
That's typically where the prosecutors that work for me appear in front of a grand jury to present them the evidence that somebody's committed a felony crime and be held accountable for it. However, there is another sentence in that same constitutional section that talks about an investigative grand jury. And what that references is a grand jury that can look at other things. The classic example would be, for example, jails. The Constitutional Convention minutes, as well as much of the research around this area, uses the idea of looking at correctional facilities. The grand jury, back at the time of the Constitution, back in the late 50s, early 60s, the idea was that there would be a group of 12 to 18 citizens who could go and visit the jails, see what conditions they were in, determine whether or not they thought the jails were operating appropriately, effectively, and if they were, great. If they weren't, then that group could get together and write a report, recommendations about what they thought ought to change, and then issue that, publish that, so that the public could read about it, and then people could decide whether or not changes should be made or not. That's essentially what an investigative grand jury does if they are not looking at criminal charges. And I say it that way because there have also been investigative grand juries where there's been conduct and people think some sort of criminal action happened. One of the more famous ones was when Governor Sheffield was accused of Governor Sheffield was accused of improper conduct in funneling money to a constituent for housing or a building or a lease or something along those lines. And when that investigative grand jury was conducted, they were evaluating whether or not criminal charges should be filed. They ultimately did not file any criminal charges, but they did issue a report. And so that's another area in which sometimes there can be investigative grand juries that result in indictments, though that's not the area that we're concerned with. We're more concerned with the area in which it's not about indictments. It would be about the functioning of OCS. It would be about some other aspect that people are concerned about. And so we have seen requests for those sorts of things. You asked me about why the increases. Why are we asking for it now? I would tell you that investigative grand juries were part of the Constitution back in 1959. But in 64 or thereabouts, the Ombudsman's Office was created. And so before the Ombudsman's Office, if a citizen had a complaint about how state government was operating, they didn't have a place to take that to. So investigative grand juries was really where they could go with those complaints to have somebody be able to look at it and decide what should happen. But once the Ombudsman's Office was created, those complaints had a different place to funnel to, a different place to be able to address it. We saw a decrease in the requests or the demands for investigative grand juries. However, in the last, 2 to 3 years, we have had a number of citizens coming forward requesting, yea, demanding investigative grand juries on various issues. That additional increase in the last several years has been a problem for us. We have had to pull people off the line, prevent them or keep them from their prosecutorial work, and instead having to focus on these other issues. That has been a problem for us. We want to get back to having them focus on the prosecution work, but we also need to make sure that we are paying attention to what the Constitution authorizes and the ability for these grand juries to go forward and needing someone to advise them. That's what the request is about because of that increase that we've seen.
Real quick. So can you give me an idea of the number of requests for investigative grand juries that have occurred in the last year? In other words, 2, 3, or 15?
7.
Oh, right in the middle. Okay. Thank you. That's good enough.
Representative Galvin, Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Edgman, through the chair. I have some questions about this because of what you've just stated with regard to the history. You mentioned that the Office of Ombudsman was put in place as a placeholder to do some of this work or something similar to it to help adjudicate, so to speak, those who had concerns or questions. And I think we heard a few weeks ago from, I believe it might have been Steve Williams, if I'm not incorrect. I think he may be overseeing the, I think Mental Health Trust might be overseeing that. And what we heard there was that they've been very successful, and they want more help. They want, I think, to add 2 more positions there. And so I'm trying to evaluate where the work needs to happen and thinking through, they want to have some more support. You clearly want some more support. I'm hearing 7 cases. They gave us in the order of hundreds, plus the other work that they do with regard to, I think, long-term care facilities, et cetera. And so I guess what I would ask of you is, this sounds very specific, like there's something with 7 cases. Can you give me a general theme of what the concern is and share, if you're allowed to, are they allowed to go through the Office of Ombudsman to try to do that same sort of work of finding a solution?
Chair, Representative Galvin, there are some of those requests that have also been directed towards the Ombudsman's office as complaints. The Ombudsman's office has investigated, has issued reports or done what they do in their cases, but that doesn't change a citizen's desire to also have another body look at this sort of conduct. The process that has to be done is you have to look at whether or not the complaint qualifies for public welfare or safety. If it does, then it would be appropriate for an investigative grand jury to look at that. I've talked with the Ombudsman's office, and they tell me that what they particularly look at is individual cases, whereas I would tell you an investigative grand jury is designed to look at public welfare, because that's what the Constitution says, and the term public means that it's not about one single incident, but rather has to be something broader that affects the public at large. So that's part of the evaluation that has to be done. But if it does affect the public at large, it may be appropriate both for the ombudsman and for a investigative grand jury. I hope that answers your question. If there's more to it, I'm happy to circle back around again.
Thank you, Chair. I think for now we'll let that sit. Thanks.
It looks like we have 2 more questions on the left-hand side of the table. Just looking at 8 more slides and the court system. Representative Hannon and Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Chair Edgman. So I've served once on a criminal grand jury, and I'm just trying to envision how an impaneled group of 18, and when I served on the criminal grand jury here, it was a weekly meeting for a period of months, which is not a very good way to do an investigation, but we were dealing with discrete cases. So is this grand jury, the investigative grand jury, impaneled for a period of 2 weeks to travel the prisons of Alaska as a posse of 18 and investigate and then report back with a conclusion? Or because you've got your employee side, but the grand jury itself is still a citizen impaneled group. And My understanding is we are still struggling to regularly impanel juries that could provide the time commitment and perhaps skills to do something like a grand jury investigation.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, I absolutely agree with you that there would be significant time demands. They would not travel the state. Grand juries really are focused on conduct that occurs within their area, and by that there are judicial rules that talk about where grand juries are supposed to be impaneled and set out the geographic area that they would actually cover. So they'd only look at things within their area, not traveling the entire state. But yes, I do think that there is a concern about how much those requests or those grand juries eat into the criminal grand juries. But all of this is why you need dedicated personnel to review these requests, decide what's appropriate with them when they do go to a grand jury, to make sure that they are very focused and that it is controlled, because otherwise it will sort of be kind of all over the map. And that's not beneficial to anybody in the state when that happens.
One follow-up?
Follow-up.
Could the purpose be served by beefing up the ombudsman and giving them additional investigatory authority and more employees, or even a grand jury purpose, or is that exclusive to the court system?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, I believe that the ombudsman could be empowered to do those sorts of things. They're not currently. And whether or not the ombudsman's office could deal with the investigation to the exclusion of considering an investigative grand jury, I would tell you what I've heard from the citizens is that the Constitution says there's an investigative grand jury and they want to avail themselves of what's available in the Constitution, and they shouldn't be denied that opportunity simply because there's another avenue that may be available.
Thank you.
All right. Oh, you're on the same page we were on when I left. We're going to go.
The good news is I think we're ready to shift to the civil division.
Well, we have a question from Representative Josephson, I think. And then we'll go ahead and shift over after that.
Well, thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Skidmore, where does this come to an end? Or is this just cyclical? I'm thinking of American history. There was the Great Awakening and great spiritualism in the country. And then that dies down. It comes back. Mm-hmm. Is this, we're just going to work our way through this and the public will be given its opportunity? I mean, my concern is that what I think I hear is that your office doesn't have any discretion, not much. And so we end up with cases like Judge Murphy's, which was just tossed and may have wasted a lot of time. And then I realize, well, there are trials that don't result in convictions all the time. And one could say maybe they weren't such a great use of time. How do you respond to those comments?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, first, I'm not going to comment on any active or pending cases. That particular one also happens to be assigned to a special prosecutor, so I don't know the details of it, so it wouldn't be appropriate for me to try and comment on it. But beyond that, the heart of your question, I believe, is do I see this as a trend or a fad, something that's going to fade? I wish I had a crystal ball and could answer that question. I can only deal with what I've seen in the last 2 to 3 years, and I recognize the need, the demand that it's making on my division. And in order to address that, this request is in front of you today. Whether that continues in 5 to 10 years from now, I'm afraid I don't know.
Okay, short question.
Very short.
So with that, you're asking for three more positions. Is this in the base? Are these permanent?
Through the chair, Representative Cologne. Yes.
Thank you.
Hey, Corey Mills. For the record, being respectful of time, I will try to get through this fairly quickly, but happy to answer questions. Again, I oversee the civil division here at the Department of Law, and the best way I think to describe the civil division is if you look at your statute books and you take out 11 and 12, we cover everything else. So the civil division kind of advises every other agency that doesn't relate specifically to the criminal division and prosecution. And so we're really about providing high quality legal services to all of those departments. this is an overview. I'll go through these asks as Mr. Skidmore did individually. I just want to point out that the way the Civil Division's budget works is we're about half funded by what we call interagency receipts, so other departments pay us for that work. The purpose of that is actually, for example, when you have the Department of Health, they get federal funding that comes in. That federal funding can be used to pay for their legal services. So we need to bill them for that in order for us to use those federal funds in that way. So that's one of the reasons we actually bill our agencies for our work, is to make sure we're utilizing all the funds in the most appropriate manner. So about 50% of our budget is interagency receipts, 50% is our own general fund that is given to the Department of Law, which is really what our budget is focused on. The other element I'll focus on is we do have some statutorily designated program receipts, and I'll get into that with one of our asks, but I just want to point out that we do have kind of different sources of funding for these requests. So the first, this is really just a restructure of our budget. We presented this last year. We did kind of reorganize a little bit, but currently the Civil Division's budget has 15 components. I think it's one of the largest number of components inside a division. And we've just found that that has created a lot of administrative burdens and hurdles for us, as our administrative staff has to move things between the different components. It also creates inflexibility in us in terms of organizing our sections and our work more appropriately. And so what we propose is to actually take it from 15 to 5 and try to encapsulate the main areas of work we do. So the first one is protective legal services and support, or another way to think of this is health, safety, and welfare. So you've got, you know, your Department of Health work, your Department of Family and Community Services, Child Protection, all of our occupational licensing work, as well as our regulatory affairs and public advocacy. That is our public interest attorney that sits and represents the public interest before the Regulatory Commission of Alaska on utility rates. Then you have agency advice and representation. This is where we're, you know, defending the state and advising most of our main core services as a state. So when we get sued, our torts, we have workers' compensation where we're representing the state as the employer. And then our Department of Corrections also has quite a bit of inmate litigation where we're defending the state against those lawsuits. Our Labor and State Affairs section, this is elections, employment law, you know, kind of your core services as a state. And then public corporations and governmental services, exactly what it sounds like. All of our public corporations are represented by this section. They also represent the Department of Education as they have a lot of funding involved. And this is really a finance fiscal section. Also represents Department of Revenue in our treasury. The next is resource development and infrastructure, you know, all of our environmental work, our transportation work, oil and gas, as well as natural resources. And then government services really covers our sections that do work on behalf of all agencies, as well as in support of other sections within the Department of Law. Opinions, appeals, and ethics, they represent the state in appeals. We have special litigation on here, which does a lot of our high-level controversial litigation. Legislation, regulations section, and then information and project support. These are the people who help with public records, help with our discovery, e-discovery tools, as well as our internal case management system. And then what we've done is actually created a section for our legal support services. This is all of our paralegal support, all of our law office, legal office assistant support. And the purpose of this is that we have realigned our resources so that instead of having one law office assistant who's dedicated to one of these sections, we actually have them so that they can do work on a breadth of sections and help out as needed. And it's really created more of a more backup. So we don't have, if someone leaves, we don't have a big hole to fill because we have backups around the Civil Division. And so the legal support services now really does support all of those different sections. So that's the restructure from 15 to 5 budget components.
One second, I need to look through the pages we have left here.
The rest of these I can probably get through fairly quickly.
All right. Representative Galvin. Representative Hand is going to follow.
Thank you, Chair Johnson, through the chair. So I'm not familiar with what it looked like beforehand with the 15 divisions. So forgive me if I'm sounding ignorant in this area, but it helps me to understand more of how you lumped them together. Health, safety, welfare, I appreciate that. Next one sounds like a lot of different disparate things to me. And so when I hear things like elections and then education, it feels truly like many, and I guess what's coming to my mind is, are we reducing staff and overarching, or is this just a new way to reorganize the way you all have are supporting each other? That's really ultimately my question, and if you could articulate that.
So through the chair, representative. It's the latter. So we are not reducing staff of any kind. It's really to reduce administrative burdens, ensure our system can be streamlined, ensure when we provide those legal support services that everything can work efficiently. We will still have sections and section supervisors over all of these sections that are listed here, and we will still be able to pull up information on each individual department, each individual section, the work they're doing, the amount of hours spent. So none of that reporting information is going to be changed. It's really just on the back end of things, it really helps our administrative services division in the way we perform on our budget and the way we can account for things.
Thank you. Right, Representative Hannah, and if we would go ahead and keep your question short, if you can. I would like to, after we finish with your questions, we'll go ahead and go through page 21, and then we'll take questions after page 21.
So my question is whether all of the statehood defense would be in the resource development, and whether any of the agents we've seen in other departments like Department of Natural Resources also has an appropriation for state of defense, and whether that's coming in an interagency reverse charge or whether they're completely separate from this.
So if I might just jump in here, there's a full section on state of defense at the very end. And so let's go ahead and go through page 21, and then we'll talk in depth about state of defense.
I'm going to leave, but I'll let them answer it and look at the date later.
We'll pick an
emergency. So child protection, one of our requests, child protection is one of our core functions. It's our largest number of attorneys do this work. I think we're at 26. The caseloads in child protection, the average caseload should be around 60 to 70, according to national averages. Ours are in the 90 to 100 range. But the other thing you have to take into account is where you're doing your cases. So a 60 cases in one jurisdiction, in one district, may look very different than 60 cases in another. And so what we're asking here is to address an issue we have in Fairbanks and our Fairbanks caseload. We have a huge burnout here. We have attorneys asking to be taken off this caseload because of the stress it induces. That's partly because of the litigious nature in this particular area, but also the fact that they'll schedule like three trials at a time. And so our attorneys have to gear up for three trials, not knowing which one is going to go forward. And it just takes a lot out of our attorneys. Right now we're rotating attorneys just to give people a break. But we feel like if we get another dedicated attorney on this caseload, we can take down those caseload numbers and just relieve the system overall. So we're hoping one child protection attorney as well as one paralegal to help with that caseload. And consumer protection, when I talked about statutory designated program receipts, this is an area where we're not asking for general fund money to come from the Treasury to Department of Law. This is actually an account that the Department of Law already has. We just want to increase the authority to spend from this account. This account is filled with funds from consumer protection settlements that come in. Some of those settlements require that the money be used for consumer protection efforts. And in total, it makes up about 5% of what we bring in. The 95% we bring in goes into the general fund. So all we're asking for here is to increase that authority to have one attorney, one investigator, one paralegal. The reason for this is we have currently sitting 17 investigations that we're unable to work on due to a lack of staff. And we've had a lot of success. We expanded the section in 2018, and we were able to, we filed 12 cases since that time. The 5 years prior to 2018, we had only filed one case. That's an Alaskan specific case. So having filed 12 cases, we also, this is a section that brings money into the state. We've brought in over $25 million in civil penalties in the last 5 years. $1.3 million has been given in restitution to consumers around the state for actions we've brought. And then that doesn't even count the opioid settlements that we've entered into, which will total around $100 million for the state. So hoping that we can get this increased authority so we can help more consumers as well as bring in more revenue. Regulation review fund source change. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this one. Basically, we had an antiquated way of accounting for our regulation review, which is a statutorily required role of the Department of Law. We're an independent check on all regulations projects. And the way that work was getting paid for was this very confusing formula based on the past so many years and how many pages of regulations each department had. It didn't fit with our current billing model. So again, it created that administrative burden because we always had to do this differently than everything else. The request is to bring that money, just a GF, to the Department of Law to pay for that work. I think philosophically it also makes sense because this is an independent role we play. We're not doing it on behalf of agencies. We're doing it because the statutes say the Department of Law needs to make sure that all regulations don't conflict with statute and don't conflict with the Constitution. So the total for that is changing from a $448,000 interagency receipt authority and changing that to actually undesignated general fund. So that was if 21.
If I might on the chargeback. So where you were charging back to the department that you were reviewing?
Well, Chair Johnson, it was a little more complicated than that. It was, we were charging back to each department, but it was kind of based on this formula average over time. So it wasn't based on the actual number of hours spent on that department. So yes, but no.
And so from what you're saying, there's not like you could charge some other agency that's actually getting federal funds for something for it. This is all internal. This is state, you know, state to state work. Is it the, from what I heard? What you
said. Chair Johnson, that's absolutely correct.
And here, if I may,
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Deputy Attorney General, when you review regs, so even the seemingly smallest, most benign barbers and hairdressers rulemaking gets a look from someone in your department. Is that right?
Through the chair, correct. Thanks. We also verify if they followed public notice procedures, all of those procedural steps that are required by the Administrative Procedures Act, as well as the actual substance of the regulation. Okay, state of defense. My last slide. I think you have all heard over the past, I think it's 3 years now, of requests for multi-year spending for statehood defense efforts. This is really about asserting the state's ownership and management rights relating to land and natural resources. There's been specific language in the budget that has given us money that we could use over a period of time. This shows you the historic spending and what we have to date. So the first year we got this was in fiscal year 21, and that one's going to expire next year, but we're basically, you know, it says 3,503, and I think I just talked to our administrative staff that said that's basically gone. So if you look at all we've really got remaining is that, the multi-year that was related to the Tongass. We still have some money there, but we're really now relying on the last budget line, which we got last year. You graciously gave us $5 million for those efforts. We've started spending into that. So the proposal this year is to give the department $2 million in a, I think it's called a temporary increment. This is how our oil and gas used to be funded. So basically it won't go into our base, but the thought is to come back and get $2 million every year. We think that will sustain us on these efforts for now. And then, you know, if hopefully in the future we don't have as many federal actions taking place where we have to take part in it, we could look at reducing that amount. But for now, we think this will get us where we need to go.
We have a question, Representative Stapp, followed by Representative Ortiz.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Through the chair to the wonderful people at law, how's our record on statehood defense? Are we winning any of these things, or are we, like, not?
So there is, first I want to, statehood defense efforts can be very broadly, through the chair, I apologize, can be very broadly interpreted. We have a number of actions. In terms of this money, we did provide a list to the committee of what this money is being funded for. So I just want to point out that the number of actions we have a federal law and litigation report. There's about 50 actions on there. The number being funded through this source of funding, because we're trying to use our money appropriately, depending on the source, is a smaller list. But going to the question about successes. One, I don't think we've had, I think we've only had one or two cases actually conclude, because litigation takes a long time. I will say that successes that I would call in this general area are Willow. We've been defending that. It is on appeal. The polar bear incidental take regulation. We have successfully defended that. That's also on appeal, though, so not done. We also saved the fishing season here in Southeast last summer. There was going to be something that shut down all Southeast troll fisheries, and we were able to prevent that from happening. Again, that is on appeal, so it's not completed. Sackett, I would say it was a success on the waters of the United States. We filed an amicus brief in that United States Supreme Court case that came out in the way we had argued. We also successfully got a preliminary injunction stopping the federal government from enforcing their new version of waters of the United States on Alaska, which would cover 173 million acres of wetlands in our state. And so those are things I would point out as successes, but we're not across the finish line on any of those yet. Most of them are still pending in some form or another.
Okay, thank you.
I did want to take just one moment to answer Rep. Hannon's question. She had asked about the source of where this funding is. In these past efforts, there was specific language in the budget. So that money is kind of outside of what I would say our regular budget structure is. This year, it would fall under that resources and infrastructure, but the intent behind how that money would be spent is the same as how we've spent the money to date.
Just a follow-up on that answer. She had specifically pointed to the one section, one of the five units that we have. And it actually does spill over into our opinion appeals because as these things move on through the court system, we trade hands from the litigator to the appeals attorney.
Representative Edson.
Is there a need to have statehood defense? Maybe this is to the attorney general. Is there a need to have statehood defense defined in law? Because my research indicates there's no definition in regulation, there's no definition in statute, there's a definition in terms of precedence and practice for sure. But it's a term of art that's, you know, at one point really sort of involved your department as well as Department of Natural Resources. Just a few days ago, we had the Department of Fish and Game in front of us asking for two positions tied to state of defense. And with, you know, agencies having the ability to interagency, you know, transfer between agencies, and your department certainly is a sort of a crossroads, it seems, for all agencies in that regard. But I think we all agree that state of defense is valid, right? It's something that we've always been involved in, regardless of who was at the helm in the executive branch. but it just seems to me to be open-ended and not defined. And as appropriators, we're asked to give X amount of dollars, and we get reports back that, it's always a work in progress, right? Always. And I understand the nature of court cases and appeals and things like that, but it just strikes me that we don't have any definition of law for it, and the time might be coming to actually get that done.
Yeah. Representative Edgeman, through the chair, Greg Taylor, you're absolutely correct. And we have been very careful with the way we use those statehood defense funds, trying to make sure we're not putting anything in there that's going to cause controversy or we've also tried to be very transparent on which cases we're using those funds for. And like, for example, we have the list here. We're happy to provide it again to you. I think it has been provided to the committee. And so we've been cognizant of the fact that there is some wiggle room in there. And if we wanted to be cute as a department, we could probably use some of these things that would be controversial down here. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to focus that money, use it responsibly on what we envision as the meat and potatoes of statehood defense, and use it in that manner. But you're right. I mean, if the legislature wanted to put and to make a definition on statehood defense, they could do that.
Can I follow up before?
Follow up.
Yeah, and the last couple of times that I've spoken at the AFN board, and perhaps you have as well, Attorney General, this issue has come up, and again, because it's right open-ended, it's not defined, what is statehood defense, term of art, all this stuff. Mm-hmm. But are you able to assure me that that discretion that you're applying isn't spilling over into a subsistence case that is at hand?
Representative Edgeman, through the chair, yes, what we represent is what we're spending, that we are faithful to that representation. There's no spillover.
And Corey Mills, again, for the record, I actually personally have to approve what this funding goes towards. So no one can assign their case to this funding source unless I see it and determine that it fits within the parameters the legislature has set forth. And that's specifically no subsistence case.
So the parameters that the legislature has set forth, I thought we just put this is just an appropriation line item, right?
So through the chair or co-chair, this year it would be a temporary increment, which is new, but in the past it has always had language associated with it that we have followed. Our view is that that intent still holds for the way it's being done this year. That language may not be in there, but the intent and the parameters that are set in place would continue to apply.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And we have Representative Josephson followed by Representative Ortiz.
Through the chair, I wasn't going to engage in this, but you said something that you said we try to avoid the controversial. That's not accurate, is it? I mean, and part of me says it's okay, Mr. General Taylor, it's okay in that that's the nature of your work, is it's controversial. But all of this is controversial, isn't it?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, yeah, happy to answer that question. With the statehood defense funds, we're cognizant of our reliance on the legislature for that funding and the good that the state does, and we try to really hone in on what that's used for and keep statehood defense funding from entering that controversy that happens when you have an executive, a legislature, and a judiciary, right? And so when we wade into those controversial matters, because we do, I have a boss, he is the governor. And so when we get into those types of situations, yeah, sure, we're going to have disagreements on whether that's wise funding that the Department of Law is using or not. And people are going to disagree. But what we're trying to say with the statehood defense, we're trying to keep it in the parameter that it's not going to be overly controversial for everyone involved. And again, making it very transparent on what we're using those funds for in case the legislature does have an issue with how we're using those funds.
Okay, thank you.
All right, very good. Representative Ortiz. And then.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, I got two questions. One is in specificity to the Department of Law and DNR in relationship to RS 2477, you are, is it correct to say that the resources that DNR is using to move that litigation comes from the Department of Law. Is that correct? Are you supporting that?
So Corey Mills, again, for the record, through the chair, representative. Actually, the Department of Natural Resources has gotten funds for their expertise. So when they need to gather all the historical evidence to get us to the point where we can do litigation, that is being funded by Department of Natural Resources to their, I can never remember what the acronym means, but the PAD unit. The funds here are used specifically for the legal services associated with the litigation and perhaps some experts that need to be brought in after the fact. So it's a combination.
And a follow-up, if I may?
I just want to make note, go ahead and ask your questions, and I want to give you guys an opportunity to make a final statement, and we do have courts that we will do next.
So go ahead, ma'am.
Representative Ortiz, perfectly.
Okay.
Perfectly fine.
All right. So on the RS-2477 litigation, could you just tell me what that's about? Quickly, just summarize what that's about.
So through the chair, representative, there was a statute, an old mining statute, that basically allowed public access to be developed through use, right? And a state could assert that it has, that it wants to own this as a public right-of-way. So that's what they were. It cut off at a certain time, so you have to have historical evidence of use of that area. A lot of them are old mining trails. The Iditarod Trail is an example of an RS-2477. The Dalton Highway was an RS-2477. So those are examples. Some of them are small trails. Some of them are large roads and thoroughfares that we're using now.
Thank you.
We're good. Thank you.
Thank you for your presentation. We always appreciate having the Department of Law. We always know we should have more time because people always have lots of questions for you. If there's anything you would like to, anything you want to say in closing, please do.
Chair, Ms. Trike Taylor, just in closing, we're appreciative of all your time and effort and obviously reviewing what we have before you, and always interested in answering any questions that you may have even outside of this hearing. If you want to reach out to us directly, we try to be as transparent as we can and work with you all, and are happy to do so. So thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. So we'll take a brief at ease while we wait for a reset on our court presentation. All right, welcome to House Finance. We have a Finance Committee overview from the Alaska court system. We have here today to present in the room Doug Willeber, Deputy Administrative Director for the Alaska court system. And online we have Rhonda McLeod, the Chief Financial Officer for the court system. And I am going to go ahead and let you just... Thank you. Welcome to House Finance. I'm going to go ahead and let you get started. Thank you for being so patient, and we do appreciate you sitting through our other presentation and being here with us today.
Thank you for having me, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Doug Willeber. I'm the Deputy Administrative Director for the Alaska Court System. This is our mission statement, and our mission statement focuses on access, impartiality, just resolutions of all the cases that come before us, and This is the Department of Law mentioned. This is their mission statement, kind of guides everything they do, similar to ours. Our mission statement guides everything that we do. And not only in the way we resolve cases, but in all of our dealings with the general public as well. This is just a quick slide. It shows what you all know. State government is mostly the executive branch. Judicial branch makes up about 1.5% of the overall state spending. And our budget, the Alaska court system, is mostly trial courts. That's where almost all of our employees are. That's where almost all the cases are resolved. That's where most all of the judges are. Another way to look at our budget is, like most kind of service-oriented organizations, we are largely, most of our budget is personnel. And between personnel and facilities-related expenses, which would be all of our leased facilities, contracts for security, janitorial, those two things together comprise about 98% of our budget. The rest is makes up the last 2%. But mostly we're personnel and facilities.
So I would like to, if you could rewind just a moment. I've had some questions as to if and as the court system is a separate branch of government, why are you in the governor's budget? And if you would just maybe review how you've been and, you know, how it's been in the past and how the court system budget gets submitted.
Madam Chair, just like the tradition of the state has been for many, many years, is that the legislature's in the budget, courts are in the budget, executive branch is all in the same operating budget. We submit, and for years we have submitted our budget through the Office of Management and Budget. We go through all of their procedures. We work with them prior to the submission of our budget. And it's our position that when we put that request in, that is the judicial branch's request to you. And so you're the appropriators, and this is the judicial branch's request to the legislature. And that has been the way it's been for almost the entire length of statehood. So,
all right. I just want to, I had that question, and I just want to make sure that if anybody is watching and want to know, that's why you're here before us, and that's why you're, you know, in the what we call the governor's budget submission.
Some of the things that make us a little bit different, and you'll see this makes not only our courts a little bit different, but our whole state a little bit different. We are a unified court system. There are a handful of unified court systems in the country, and that just means we don't have municipal courts and county courts. We just have one state court system. We have one state Department of Corrections. I think the Department of Corrections testified they're one of six unified correctional systems. We're almost a unified prosecutorial system. You know, the municipality of Anchorage and Juneau both prosecute misdemeanors. Outside of that, it's the Department of Law that does all the prosecuting in the state. And similar with public defender agencies. So our justice system is probably the most unified justice system anywhere in the country, which comes with a lot of efficiencies and management benefits. It gives makes it much easier for the legislature to legislate criminal laws and practices throughout the state, because we don't have counties doing a lot of the things that here is done by the state. And there are several things that impact the types of cases that come to the court system. And some of them are pretty obvious. Population changes, how many police we have, the economy. But one thing I kind of want to focus on today is that not just the number of people we have in the state of Alaska in our population, but the demographics of that population. So as we all know, Alaska has been losing working age population for a number of years now. And we also know that the population in Alaska is aging, as it is throughout the rest of the country. So that changes things. It doesn't, even if your population was the same number, it's made up differently than it used to be. Fewer working age people likely means fewer crimes committed, because those are the same age people who are most likely to be criminal defendants. Older age population means a shift in the types of cases that come to the court system. So more guardianship cases, more conservatorship cases, more estate cases. So even though, even if your numbers don't change a lot, our demographics are changing. And it isn't a year-to-year-to-year thing, but over time, we will see an increase in guardianship cases, conservatorship cases, estate cases, as our population ages. And another impact of having a smaller and smaller working age population is, well, we just heard an interesting presentation from the Department of Law about their retention and recruitment challenges. Well, the justice system, I mean, when we say this every now and then, but needs to be reminded, it really is a system. If the Department of Law is having trouble getting attorneys, that will impact how cases move through the court system. The same with the Public Defender Agency or the workers at the Office of Children's Services, the Civil Division of the Department of Law. When they have retention issues and recruitment issues, or as Mr. Skidmore was talking about, the percentage of prosecutors with very little experience, all of those things affect how cases move through the court. So it's the demographic changes in Alaska. It impacts every aspect of the state, and including how the court works. Our own vacancy rates are relatively low compared to what they are in some portions of the state. So we had a high vacancy rate of about 13.3%. We've gotten that down to 10.6%. We're budgeted for 7.3% vacancy rate. So if we were at 7.3, no one would be talking about vacancy because that's where we're supposed to be. So we're a bit above that at 10.6. We have been coming down in that vacancy rate, which isn't a huge drop, but it's moving in the right direction. And in a very challenging environment, we see that as a real win. And part of that is our recruitment efforts. We do all the things that you would expect anyone to do in recruiting. We have we go to job fairs. We have things on the state website. We have things on our own website. We have a Facebook page and all those types of things. One kind of unique thing that we just kind of stumbled upon fairly recently, the deputy director of our HR department is a military spouse, but her husband's retired now, and she was on a military spouse Facebook group. She thought, well, why don't I advertise here? Well, we've got 6 or 7 employees just from that particular little outreach, which, again, it's not a huge change in how we do business, but it was kind of an innovative way to help solve our retention and recruitment problems. And we are making gains in that area. We have another kind of metric for improvement in this area. We went from 2022, 5.3 applicants per job to 6.2. Again, it's not a huge change, but it's a move in the right direction. And that is an average. So there are still positions that are very, very difficult to fill. But overall, we're seeing an increase in how many applicants we're getting for every job. And so why do we have vacancies? There are 3 reasons we have a vacancy in a position. Retirement, and we're going to see, and this is another outcome of a change in demographics, our retirements are going up. Well, 37% of our employees are 50 or older. And that is going to, that's going to be the way it is for many, many years. But our separations are down. Those are people who just otherwise leave, not retiring. And the other way you have a vacancy is you have an internal transfer. So if a supervisor leaves court employment and another employee applies for and gets that position, there's another vacancy. So those are the 3 ways you have a vacancy. You retire, you separate, or it's an internal transfer. The separations are down. Correspondingly, the internal transfers are down. Those are good things. That's part of the benefit of the pay raise you gave court employees a few years ago. And
that's showing to be successful. It, again, these are not dramatic changes, but they are changes in the right direction. And these are the types of employees we have. So we have 776 employees in the Alaska court system. 113 of those are judicial officers. Everybody else is something other than a judicial officer. Mostly they're clerical positions. Overwhelmingly, we're a clerical-based system. But we also have court administration. My position is within court administration. Court administration covers all the things you would expect any fairly large organization to have. To do, that's where our fiscal operations, human resources, our facilities, our IT department is there. I mentioned this only because I've been around a while and it's stunning to me. But when I first came to work for the court system in 1997, we had 9 people in what we now call our IT department. And I think we have 35 now. So that's, I just find that to be astounding. But technology grows, and the staff needed to operate it grows. And these are where the locations where we are. And as you can see, so we're in 38 different communities. And mostly, of course, our employees, just like most of everything else in Alaska, is in the 3rd Judicial District, which is largely from Prince William Sound to Dillingham, and including Kodiak and the Alaska Peninsula and Aleutian Islands. That's where most of our employees are. The entire 2nd Judicial District, which is, you can see all the top in the northwest, is, there are 34 employees there.
Yes, Representative Yalman.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Quick question. I see that on the appellate court judges, there's a couple of District 1 is with 1 and District 2 with a 0. I assume they cover for each other, but just wanted to hear it from you on that side.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, we have currently one of our Supreme Court justices is based in Juneau. So there's statewide court, and we have one Supreme Court justice in Fairbanks and one Court of Appeals judge in Fairbanks. So, but there's still one court. They don't cover for each other, but they... Yeah, we in fact, we haven't had this arrangement since Justice Carpinetti was sitting on the bench. So we just got a new justice, and he's across the street. So it's good for Juneau. These are the types of people we interact with, or the ways we interact with people. We've got we're back to using juries again. We've got cases. Almost 400 people went through therapeutic courts this past year. And you see 7.7 million visits to the court's website. I just find all those numbers to be pretty interesting. In terms of our caseload, 2 years ago, we had a slight increase in our caseload. This year, we have a slight decrease in our caseload. But neither the increase 2 years ago nor the decrease this year is enough to make much of a difference, and nothing in our budget is really impacted by these relatively minor changes. The district court caseload looks like it's down a fair bit, 16.4%, but almost all of those are minor offenses, and minor offenses are fish and game tickets and mostly, almost entirely, traffic tickets. I don't know why traffic tickets are down. I doubt it's because we're all driving more safely, but nevertheless, that's what that reflects. So now we'll get to the point. What you're interested in is our budget request. We're asking for, we have a little over $3 million total increment request. Most of that is just reflects increased cost of doing business this year. We have increased costs for software maintenance and licensing. We'd like to give a small raise to our mediators, interpreters, and visitors. They're not state employees. They didn't get the recent raises. We'd like to, most of their salaries haven't been increased in a number of years. Facilities and maintenance operations, those are things like you know, almost all of our leases have a consumer price index, a provision that every year or so that it's, it's adjusted and included in there, utility costs, electrical costs. We have, I'll get to therapeutic courts in a second, security screening costs are going up, mostly in Anchorage, but around the state, a tiny bit for appellate court travel. The therapeutic court, $444,000, that covers several different items. One, the Juneau Mental Health Court has a position that's been funded for about a dozen years by the Mental Health Trust Authority, as is their practice after they've helped establish a program to get started. They asked that it transfer to the general fund. That's what that request is. And then otherwise, the therapeutic court treatment and counseling and urinalysis costs are all going up this year because the contracts for those services are being renegotiated. So the $2.6 million just keeps us doing what we have been doing for a number of years. The one thing that we are looking to do that's new, this is a $417,000 request, is a number of years, well, a few, in 2001, I think, we got a federal grant for two positions that would help monitor and oversee guardianship cases. As you have no doubt heard, either from testimony in the legislature here or news coverage, the Office of Public Advocacy has a crisis in terms of its guardianship program. This doesn't solve that program, but these three positions provide assistance for people who are guardians and conservators, and they monitor and review the thousands of annual reports that are submitted every year. Although the Office of Public Advocacy takes on public guardianship cases, most guardianship cases are private. So some of you may be a guardian for a family member or a friend. That's 71% of all guardianships are handled by friends or family. They're volunteers. These three positions will help people fill out their forms properly and timely. They cut down on the number of court hearings for delinquencies and errors in those reports. They provide training for or assistance to all the members of the public who are serving, and there are thousands of them. There are about 5,000 active adult guardianship cases in Alaska right now. Like I say, most of those just have a volunteer helping do that. So these positions will help all of those people do their jobs. It benefits OPA. It's not the main part. It's not going to solve their problem, but it benefits OPA because it allows more people to serve in this role that would otherwise just say, I don't even know how to begin to do this. And if there is nobody to do it, it goes to the Office of Public Advocacy, unless they have means, in which case a private guardian can be appointed. But most of them end up with the Office of Public Advocacy. And also people lose their guardianship if they've been delinquent many, many times in filing their reports, or there are other errors in them. Sometimes the court will say, you're not meeting the needs of your ward. It goes to OPA. So these positions aren't going to solve OPA's problem, but it will help. And then finally, these are non-UGF issues. We are looking for additional federal receipt authority, grant authority to monitor and audit some of our therapeutic courts. The Mental Health Trust Authority, every year that money comes out and goes back in. So this is just authority to receive funds from the Mental Health Trust and additional fund interagency grant receipts also for help. That's to help monitor our therapeutic courts DUI programs. So,
Chair.
That's what I have.
Representative Colon.
Thank you, Chair. Through the Chair, so can I go back to the new positions for monitoring guardianship?
Yes.
So you want three positions. They're in the base. They're not temporary, correct?
That's correct.
And these positions, would these people be mainly monitoring or mainly helping friends and family be guardians?
through the chair, Representative Cologne, they do both. Every guardian, whether you're OPA, a private professional guardian, a family member, has to submit an annual report to the court. And like I say, there are about 5,000 of those reports submitted this year. We get about 1,000 new cases a year. And because those people who have the benefits of a guardian keep that for the rest of their life. So if you're an elderly person, that might not be all that long. Mm-hmm. But if you've got a traumatic brain injury when you're 16, it'll be for 50 years. So what these monitors do is they review all of those annual reports, make sure they're accurate, make sure that everything that's supposed to be done on behalf of the ward is done, and they take phone calls and speak with people about individual guardians who have questions. And they get a lot of questions because there's a lot of forms to fill out. There's a lot of things to know. And so they have a dual role.
Follow-up? Do you have any that are doing that now? And how many do you have? How many positions?
Through the chair, Representative Cologne, we have two people doing this now who have been grant, for whom we had a federal grant. That grant is expiring. We currently cover Anchorage, Homer, Kenai, and Bethel. Yeah, Anchorage, Homer, Kenai, and Bethel. The third position would be allow us to cover guardianships in all courts in the state.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
I know this is an operating budget hearing, but if it's all right with you, I'd love to hear about the Palmer Courthouse, if that's something you want to hear about.
Oh, gee, I would really, of course I would love to hear about that, but I guess let's finish up this last page. We have a hard stop at 3:45. And we have questions, but I thought there was one more. Did I miss this page? I guess you've been through the last one. Okay, if you would just, I would also like to hear about the Palmer Courthouse as well, and if anybody has, and then we'll have an opportunity for a wrap-up.
We have a capital budget request for the Palmer Courthouse. It's our top capital budget request. It's for $35,700,000. As you all know, that is the one area in the state of Alaska that has a consistent and significant population growth. And I mentioned that slide about how things that impact, you know, number of cases that come to a court. I talked about demographics, but population is one. But the only place that population is currently a real issue is in the Mat-Su Valley. And currently the judges, Superior Court judges in Palmer are the busiest judges in the state of Alaska. We are in need of new judges, but we have a completely full courthouse. We already have one more judicial officer than we have courtrooms. We would like to add more Superior Court judges in Palmer. We need to add more Superior Court judges in Palmer. And the only way we can do that is to add more space. And it is our top priority, and we hope that it gets funded.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is it, just quickly, is it in the governor's budget, in the capital budget at this point?
It was not included in the governor's version of the capital budget, but I do hope to get it added.
Okay, thank you.
But you had submitted it. You submitted
yes.
it in your capital
yeah.
budget. Thank you. All right. I do appreciate your patience again waiting through the Department of Law and in your presentation. And so thank you very much. We'll see you. I'm sure we'll see you again at some point here. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have our next meeting on Friday, March 1st at 1:30 p.m. We will receive an overview of the proposed FY25 budget for Department of Labor and Workforce Development. And with no further business before the committee, we are adjourned at 3:34 p.m.